Sup freaks, it's your boy Marty here to introduce this rip of TFTC. This rip was brought to you by our good friends at River. River's here building up Bitcoin infrastructure. They build their own infrastructure. They don't have any third-party dependencies like Prime Trust or Fortress. They built their own wallets. They custody their own Bitcoin in multisig. If you buy Bitcoin on River, it is reserved one-to-one in multisig cold storage. You can DCA on River. If you dollar cost average, you set it and forget it. You're not going to pay any fees on those buys. You can set limit orders. Maybe you thought the price of Bitcoin was going to dump after the ETF, and you know not to buy the ETF. You need to buy actual Bitcoin. You could have set a limit order below the price of where it was when it launched. You could have set it at like 39,000. That would have been filled. You can do that on River very easily. They also have River Links, which allows you to gift people Bitcoin. It's a fascinating, incredible way to do it. You go in the River app, you create a gift, a link, a River link. You say, hey, I want to give my friend $100 worth of Bitcoin. Then you send them the link. They click the link and they can say, hey, I want to sweep this to my River account if I have it or any other wallet that I want to. It's the best way to gift Bitcoin. If you're stacking sats, if you're gifting Bitcoin, if you want to set limit orders, go to River. Go to river.com/TFTC. Sign up today. You're going to get $5 worth of Bitcoin. This rip was also brought to you by good friends down the hall, Unchained, also doing it the right way, also building their own infrastructure. What Unchained is doing revolves around multi-sig custody, 2 or 3 multi-sig quorum. It's a collaborative custody model. Their Vault product allows you to hold 2 keys. Unchained holds 1. You can distribute your risk, eliminate single points of failure. Unchained's there to be the second in the 2 or 3 multi-sig quorum if you need them. They also have an IRA product. A lot of people aping into the ETFs. Don't think that's the best idea. You should get access to actual Bitcoin that you can control. And if you want to have an IRA and Bitcoin in your IRA, go to Unchained, transition your IRA into their Bitcoin IRA, and you can hold your own keys, again, with that 2 or 3 collaborative custody model. So if you're thinking, oh, I want to invest in Bitcoin for my retirement account, I have this IRA, I don't want to liquidate it and then buy Bitcoin, you don't have to. Hit up the concierge team down the hall. Go to unchained.com/consultation. Set up a consultation. Learn about their IRA. There's many people doing it. I know many people in my family have done it. They're very happy. They feel secure. They feel happy. The Unchained team is the best in the space at onboarding people. Unchained.com/consultation. Tell them the TFTC sent you. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at CrowdHealth. In Bitcoin, we're focused on taking sovereignty back in the monetary perspective at CrowdHealth. It's taking sovereignty back from a healthcare perspective. Typical or health insurance, the industry is notoriously opaque, expensive, impersonal. CrowdHealth is a different model. It's not health insurance. It's crowdfunded healthcare. You pay a monthly fee, you pay a membership fee. You join the CrowdHealth community. If you ever need to go to the doctor, you tell CrowdHealth, hey, I'm going to the doctor. I say, all right, get us a bill. You go to the doctor, you get the bill, you give it to CrowdHealth. They negotiate the price lower, and then you pay the first $500 of that bill, and the rest gets crowdfunded by the CrowdHealth community. They've had 100% of bills paid to date. They can't guarantee that will happen, but the model seems to be working. If you're young, healthy, have a good income, you don't want to pay crazy health insurance premiums, you don't want to pay crazy healthcare costs, maybe you're unemployed, you're paying COBRA. That's what happened to me. I wasn't unemployed, but I left a company, did not get health insurance, and I was on COBRA, extremely expensive. Ditched COBRA for CrowdHealth. It's way cheaper. Me and my family love it. We've been using it, and it works. It's worked for us. We've used it multiple times throughout the last 2 years since we've been CrowdHealth community members. So go to joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC, sign up today, and you're going to get $99 for the first 6 months of your membership fee. Last but not least, this rip was brought to you by Bitcoin Talent Co. Bitcoin Talent Co. is here to help you find the best talent in the world. If you're a company building out the space, so a lot of the companies we talked about, John and I, in this episode, if they need to hire, some of them are using Bitcoin Talent Co. to go hire what they need. It's a Bitcoin recruiting firm built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. They understand Bitcoin. Again, like John and I discussed, they're an inch wide and a mile deep in understanding Bitcoin. So it's not just some recruiting firm that's going to not understand what Bitcoin is and not know the talent to bring to you. They do know. They understand multisig. They understand mining. They understand Lightning. They're going to be able to find you the talent. Go to bitcointalent.co. Tell them the TFTC sent you. get onboarded with them, get the best talent. You don't need a full-time employee. You need a contract worker. Guess what? They have a flex program that allow you to tap into a roster of people who are willing to work for short periods of time, 3 months, 6 months, whatever you need. You need a design sprint, an engineering sprint. You need a part-time CFO. Bitcoin Talent Co. can find those people for you. BitcoinTalent.co. Tell them the TFTC sent you. Wasn't last but not least, also new sponsor. Been drinking electrolytes to supplement my water, my hydration. Salt of the earth. Go to drink, S-O-T-E, drinksote.com. drinksote.com/TFTC. Check it out. With that TFTC promo code, you'll get 15% off. Enjoy this rip. Tiki.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Aaron, this is a long time coming. This is your first time on TFTC, which is embarrassing on my part.
It is, yeah. We came close one time in New York, I think, but I wasn't close enough to actually come on the show.
Yeah.
And now I think David was on. David Bailey was on, and I think you DM'd me, but I was like not actually in the physical building or something. I recall something. But yeah, this is the first time I'm on.
That was a consensus 2019, I think. Maybe 2018.
One of these, yeah. Yes.
I think it was right after 2017 because there's still somewhat bull vibes. So I think it was 2018. But I'm happy we're doing this now. We're here to talk about your new book, the Genesis book, the story of the people and projects that inspired Bitcoin. But before we get to that, I wanted to walk you through a pivotal point of my Bitcoin story that you were involved in, which revolves around the Bitcoin's Moby Dick research that Laurent did into the spamming attack on the Bitcoin network around 2015, 2016. I don't know if you recall, but Laurent put together a Slack channel. And at one point it was me, you and him trying to dissect the chain data of the spam attack. And I had no idea what I was looking at, but you and Laurent were conversing back and forth. And I was just observing from afar of you guys diving into this data.
I do remember this. I definitely remember the term you mentioned, the Moby Dick spammer. And I remember, did I write an article about it in the end? Probably, right?
I think so. I think Laurent wrote a series on it as well.
Yeah, I don't remember the actual details, but I just remember that this happened, yeah. But yeah. I couldn't tell you anything about it anymore. I just, the name rings a bell, and I know I was sort of there for it, yeah.
Yeah, from what I recall leading up to the fork wars, obviously the fork wars revolved around the fact that Bitcoin fees were high. We need to increase blocks, one faction thought. And Laurent basically identified that somebody was spamming the mempool with 564 sat transactions. And he was using OXT.me to visualize that. And we were in the Slack channel. And for me, that was pivotal in my point, really like diving into chain data and better understanding like the nuances of UTXOs and how they can affect the fee market.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was a lot of shenanigans going on around that time, including, yeah, these spam attacks to sort of make the blocks look full, even though they weren't really at the time. I definitely remember all that kind of stuff going on, which ironically kind of proved the point of why you need a block size limit, because otherwise you can just spam blocks to infinite sizes. So yeah.
Yeah.
At least with a block size limit, it's expensive to do it.
Yeah. And at this time, I think it was 27 or 2018. I thought it was so cool. And I was in a Slack channel with you. I think I've been following you for almost a decade now. And what you've been doing, writing about Bitcoin, everything you've done at Bitcoin Magazine. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm in this Slack channel with Aaron Van Weerden and Laurent, like digging to this chain data that I have no idea what it's saying to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a pivotal part of my Bitcoin story is being in that Slack channel with you. and observing.
Cool.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I like I said, you have a better memory of this event than I have. I remember it happened, but that's pretty much it.
I mean, you've probably forgotten more than people have ever known about Bitcoin. Most people on the planet, with all the research that you've done, all the writings that you've done, all the research that you've done, not only into Bitcoin itself, but with this book, the Genesis book, digging into the history of the precursors, technologies, and economic theory that led to Bitcoin. What's it been like in the space?
I have forgotten more than most people know about Bitcoin. That's what you said. I mean, that's probably true because most people don't know a lot about Bitcoin.
Exactly.
Plus, I have a bad memory, so it has to be true what you just said. Yeah.
Yeah. So what's it been like covering the space for you?
In general?
Yeah. What's it been like? Why do you cover it?
Like, why did I even start covering this?
Yeah.
I mean, I think Bitcoin, let's say money is an important tool for humanity, right? Arguably the most important tool. So I actually studied like political history. There's a longer name to it, but I was also, I was always interested in sort of how do people organize? So how does society organize? You know, what political systems have been tried? Economic theories, like it was sort of always something I found interesting. And even before Bitcoin, I'd gotten interested in both finance, like the whole financial crisis had been happening, of course. So that sort of attracted my attention. But then also the free and open source software movement, which had its own kind of ideology, own way of cooperating, which I also describe in my book for a part. And with Bitcoin, these two really came together. It's an open source form of money. And that just blew my mind. Like while everyone was talking about either reforming banks or especially in the United States, maybe ending the Fed, and Bitcoin just sort of did it. And for me, that felt like a very interesting and potentially incredibly important breakthrough that at first I wanted to just write a couple of articles or start with one, but then, you know, the more I learned, the more I realized that this is just gonna be my career now. I started a blog at first and then a new site and started freelancing for Bitcoin publications, and I'm still here. Now I wrote a book. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a good layup to talk about the book. I think that's one of the misconceptions around Bitcoin from people who aren't really involved and are looking at it from the outside in. They see it as this technology that came out of nowhere, and many have equated it to the MySpace of the cryptocurrency space. But what you're diving into here in the Genesis book is that's not true. Bitcoin is really the culmination of almost a century of advances in political theory, economic theory, and then computer science as well. Many tried and failed to release digital currencies over the last three decades, and it wasn't until Satoshi gifted the world with the white paper and the protocol that we actually found a digital currency that seems to be working.
Yeah, for me personally, I knew about some of these earlier projects in the same way I think many Bitcoiners, especially these days, will sort of know that there were these other projects. Although when I started writing, I think that was still kind of a mystery for many people. There was still sort of this idea that Bitcoin really came out of nothing. And like you just explained, it really didn't. But even if you know it didn't, like for me personally, a couple of years ago, I knew there was this thing called BitGold that Nxabo worked on, and there was this Hashcash and B-Money, which is mentioned in the white paper. But for me, that was sort of it. There were like footnotes in the white paper. There was this one page in a Bitcoin book that mentions the cypherpunks and that mentions that there was this thing going on, these people before Bitcoin that were interested in this stuff. But that was sort of it. And for me, at that point, I'd been writing about Bitcoin for multiple years. I'd been exploring it through my articles, myself understanding how it all works. And also, especially during the block size wars, which you mentioned, kind of being in the middle of this debate about the future of Bitcoin. So it's really covering it intensely for years. And at some point, I felt like I want to know more about where this actually came from. I want to know more about what is this actual prehistory that's sort of alluded to in this one page in the chapter one of this other Bitcoin book. Like, what are they actually talking about? What is the story here? What did drive these people? So that's what I set out to do for the past couple of years. I've been working on this book for a couple of years. In the meantime, I also published several articles, sort of standalone articles, on the specific digital cash projects that came before Bitcoin. These were called the Genesis Files. And now, yeah, the Genesis book really kind of tries to wrap it all in one big story. Also includes a lot more of the economic foundations of Bitcoin and how that all sort of interplays and ultimately led to Bitcoin. That's the goal anyways. That's what I set out to do.
Yeah. And so how far back does this go? Where do you draw the line of like, all right, here's the first step toward Bitcoin? What part of history?
Yeah, so it starts with the Arabs inventing zero. That's actually a Dilbert comic joke. Do you know this?
No.
It's his Dilbert comic where someone asks, okay, explain blockchain to me, and then that's where he starts with the invention of zero. Explain it to me, but don't give me the... I don't remember the exact joke. Anyways, so actually I start my book... So there's two starting points in my book, essentially. It starts with two legs, if you will, there's two storylines in the book. One of them is really the economic part. So the book opens with Hayek, well, not counting the introduction. The book opens with Hayek. And then in the first part of the book, I explore Hayek's thinking about money. And I choose Hayek specifically because I think in different parts of his life, he had ideas that were very relevant to Bitcoin. Like early in his career, he was sort of musing about this neutral money, which would be a currency with a limited supply that could be used internationally, borderless. So very much resembles Bitcoin. Later in his career, he proposes that money should be left to the free market. And then even later in his career, he sees the only way to enable that is to create something that governments can't stop. There's this famous Hayek quote that many Bitcoiners will have heard. So Hayek sort of has this recurring role in my book, and that's one side of the story. And then the other side of the story starts with the emergence of the hacker culture. So it starts with at MIT, essentially, where the first computers are brought on campus, and hacker culture emerges, which is really based on this idea of sharing their code, and free software and open source software comes from that. And this storyline proceeds with the invention of public key cryptography, and it all sort of starts to merge with the cypherpunks. So in the cypherpunks try to create digital cash. Some of them, I already briefly mentioned, like Nick Szabo's BitGold, and there was Halvini at ARPAO, YDAI at B-Money, which is referenced in the white paper. So at this point, these cypherpunks want to create digital cash, and they're really inspired, I would say, by these two different kind of ideological movements that sort of become one at that point. And also in the book, at that point in the book, it sort of becomes a more singular storyline with these different projects sort of following each other up.
Yeah, and that's
so to give you a specific like beginning date, the Hayek storyline starts basically in the 1920s, although even there's sort of like this flashback which goes a bit further into history, like where Austrian economics sort of emerges, so that's 19th century. And then the tech track that sort of starts in the late 50s, early 60s.
Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating because it seems, having been in Bitcoin for 10 years and looking back, seems like, I personally believe that we've been going astray as a society for the greater part of 100 years due to fiat money and central banks. And the implications of that are pretty massive, as we talk about day in and day out within the Bitcoin community, and more people are starting to talk about it more broadly. But the fact that it took sort of individuals in the economic theory realm, and then individuals in the software development and cryptography realm, to really take it upon themselves to fix this problem is extremely inspiring, especially when you consider honing in on the cypherpunks particularly. They were working on this for decades and failing over and over again, but failing forward with things like PGP and other cryptographic primitives and Hashcash leading to Bitcoin eventually. And so how do you think the cypherpunk, like how quickly do you think the cypherpunks, when they initially set out on this journey to create a digital currency, how quickly do you think they believed it would take initially compared to how long it actually took leading up to Bitcoin's launch?
Well, first to remark on what you said, like it is an insanely inspiring story indeed, right? Especially, let's just assume that Bitcoin sort of succeeds, and we're not there yet. But if it does, it's such a major accomplishment of this small group of people. And it was a small group of people. Like it was, you know, in the hundreds, maybe at its very peak, there were like 2,000 people on the Cypherpunks mailing list. But then most of them were just readers. Like the people that were really driving it forward was such a small group. Like if Bitcoin succeeds, then I would really expect future historians to look back on these guys, like Americans in particular, sort of look back on the founding fathers, right? It's a small group that actually achieved something really massive, which is super interesting. Now I forgot your question. What was your actual question before I riffed on?
What do you think their expectations were when they initially set out to launch a digital currency compared to how long it actually took?
Right. Well, keep in mind, so when the cypherpunks started working on digital cash kind of already existed. I want to say existed, even though that's a little bit of a shortcut. So you had David Chaum. David Chaum, cryptographer, he essentially invented digital cash in the 80s. And when I say digital cash in this context, I very specifically mean, or he very specifically meant, a form of currency for the internet that can be used anonymously. So the strong emphasis for Chaum in particular was on privacy, anonymity. He wasn't trying to like reinvent money, or he wasn't a, you know, gold bug or none of that. He was just trying to achieve privacy. And this is also initially what attracted the first cypherpunks to digital cash technology. Now, it was in development at that time. So cypherpunks were launched sort of 1992. And at that point, David Chaum already had his startup called DigiCash in Amsterdam, which started in 1990. So when the cypherpunks at first thought about digital cash, they kind of thought about the thing David Chaum was building. That's what inspired them, and that's what they were trying to achieve, you could say. So this was just centralized. It was a technology for banks, so banks could use it, offer it to their customers, and then the digital cash you had was basically, you know, had a one-on-one value backed by whatever fiat currency the bank had. So this existed, but David Chaum did take some design decisions, or his company was going in certain directions, or was making certain trade-offs that not all the cypherpunks were really happy with. So one of them was DigiCash was really sort of focusing on hardware modules. There was a strong focus on making payments in real life rather than over the internet, which sort of makes sense if you think back to the era, right? Like early 1990s, most people didn't even have internet yet. So the focus was on making, in-person digital payments and making these anonymous. So that was one of the focus that not all the cypherpunks were happy with. They thought you should just focus on, you know, internet currency and focus on the crypto protocols. And then there was also an even bigger trade-off, which had to do with privacy. Like in Chaum's model, the recipient of a transaction wasn't necessarily private to the sender. Because if the sender would collude with the bank, then they could sort of work together to, you know, de-anonymize the recipient. And Chaum thought this was probably a good trade-off because that way extortion would be, you know, kind of impossible, or, you know, other bad things would be harder to do if the recipient could be de-anonymized in the worst case scenario. Now, the cypherpunks had a more radical idea. They thought privacy is a human right, should be much more absolute. And whatever downsides come with that, that's just a trade-off we have to make as society. Yes, it will be abused by, you know, terrorists or pedophiles. Yes, they will also abuse this privacy in the same way that they're already abusing curtains. You can close your curtains, and indoors you can do whatever you want. And there's no, you know, police that can just come in. They need a warrant. Like that, these are trade-offs we make as a society. And so the cypherpunks had this strong idea that we should be making similar trade-offs. And what started to frustrate them is that they couldn't actually freely use the technology that Chaum had developed. So there's this sort of irony that Chaum and his electronic cash technology was a big inspiration for the cypherpunks. But at the same time, the cypherpunks also saw him as sort of holding up this development, because they couldn't create new forms of digital cash based on this same technology. So really, for a couple of years, it was for the cypherpunks, a very frustrating time where it seemed that this technology was sort of within reach, but they couldn't quite use it. They were trying to find ways around it. Like, they had this small kind of play currencies that were based on the same technology, and they figured if it's not used, you know, commercially, then we won't get in too much trouble. And then there were some cryptographers that were trying to make slightly different versions of Chaum's electronic cash and figuring that maybe that way they could get around the patents. But for a couple of years, it really sort of stalled and it wasn't going nowhere. And you could really see some of these guys, like Adam Back, like the frustration was really growing for them. I quote that in my book as well, how it wasn't really going anywhere. They were discussing if they should play ball with Chaum, like get his license. But yeah, it was stalling, and it really, the breakthrough happened with Hashcash. So that was like between founding the cypherpunks in 92 and creating Hashcash, that was 5 years. So there was 5 years of kind of frustration and stalling before there was this new insight of how it could actually potentially be done.
Yeah, and before we dive into Hashcash, I think you stoked an idea in my mind, which is like laying the groundwork for anybody listening to identify who you deem to be the equivalent of the founding fathers in the cypherpunk movement specifically. And it may be a big ask to make you list them all out, but in your mind, like the small group of people who were the most pivotal, excuse me.
Oh yeah, good question. I mean, Tim May has to be on that list for sure. Tim May, super interesting guy, passed away a couple of years ago, right before I could interview him. Unfortunately, I'd contacted him, but then he passed away. But he was very active. He was kind of the de facto intellectual leader, moderator, kind of very influential person on that list. Not certainly not the only one, and definitely not some sort of official leader, because the cypherpunks sort of by design were this decentralized group where no one was in charge. There were no hierarchies. It was just this group of like-minded people that shared a goal, that met either in real life or on a mailing list to discuss their ideas and strategies. But Tim May was very pivotal. He was one of the founders, and he was also the most active contributor to the mailing list, where he would consistently share his ideas and what he expected cryptography to be able to achieve. And he in particular had a very radical interpretation of the potential of cryptography. He wrote a crypto anarchist manifesto, mm-hmm. and which I have behind me on the poster, by the way, printed out. And he saw cryptography and digital cash in particular as tools to really undermine the state. It would allow people to not pay taxes, which would in turn lead to a tax revolt, and also like secrets. It would be impossible to keep secrets, so including government secrets or big corporations couldn't keep secrets. And if you can't keep secrets, it's really hard to run a large corporation like that. So he had these very radical ideas, but there were also moderate or more moderate cypherpunks on there. Eric Hughes, for example, was a lot more moderate, but he's another co-founder. John Gilmore, another co-founder. And then some of the more well-known guys in the Bitcoin space would, for example, be, you know, Nick Szabo, Hal Vinny, Wydai. They were all quite active on there as well. But yeah, there were a whole bunch of people that were discussing these kinds of ideas and digital cash tools and also just general privacy technologies, of course.
Yeah. And you have to imagine like a distributed workforce working on a combination of open source and closed source technologies aiming for this ideal. Like, was there any similar type of software projects or movements like this before that? Few, if any, I imagine. Outside of like internet protocol stack, but.
Yeah, well, Phil Zimmerman, he was building PGP, and he did start building that before the cypherpunks existed. And then, of course, David Chaum was building electronic cash as well before, like, he was the inspiration for the cypherpunks, or one of the inspirations. So he was also building that before the cypherpunks. But in general, not really, or at least the types of tools that cypherpunks were developing, so privacy tools, essentially, that didn't really exist yet before the cypherpunks. In fact, that's why the cypherpunks were founded. That's why Tim May and Eric Hughes and John Gilmore, why they wanted to found the cypherpunks, because there was this revolution in cryptography that had been happening since the 1970s. But to actually turn these crypto protocols into tools that people could use, that hadn't really happened yet. So that's what they try to achieve, and that's why they gathered this groups of hackers and friends and computer scientists to start building this and start realizing this.
Yeah, and in your research, like going back and reading the mailing list and all the papers that were put out, what was it like? The coordination efforts, like in the beginning, like did you see like the coordination of these projects evolve? Like, you imagine these people are doing this for the first time. It's never been done before outside of a few projects before the cypherpunks launched. Like what was, and then you compare it to a project like Bitcoin Core today or Linux and all these other open source projects. Like how much of a rough path did they have trying to learn how to coordinate and work on this together in a distributed fashion?
Well, at the very beginning, they started to meet like at someone's apartment, right? At Eric Hughes's apartment. And they were actually sort of role playing how electronic cash, for example, could operate, or how like the precursor to Tor, like remailers, how that would actually work. So they were sort of playing this out with physical envelopes and, you know, pieces of paper and monopoly money or whatever they were using to sort of play these actual games. On the mailing list, good question. Like, you mean the actual tech development, right?
Yeah. What I'm trying to get is like the culture, like how did it sort of form and evolve around building these tools via mailing list and the combination of that meeting in person, actually writing and testing code?
Yeah, well, I think it was around this same time, so around the cypherpunk era, that Linux was also introduced, and that really sort of reshaped the culture of how to cooperate on building software, open source software specifically in general. Like before that, there was still, like free software existed. Richard Stallman had been working on free software, but there was still this ethos of you need this sort of small group of experts to build this and to vet it and to make sure it's bug free. And this tended to happen in like computer environments, like computer labs at universities. And it was really with Linux that this kind of got flipped, and it became this collaborative model across the internet where everyone could contribute. I would say the Cypherpunks mailing list specifically was more a place to sort of discuss designs and discuss ideas and discuss potential rather than a place where the actual development happened. It was more a place to sort of find each other, and they did share software, or they did share code, but it's not like it happened on the list itself. That was more a discussion forum type of situation.
Yeah. And then bringing this back to the timeline of Chom's eCash sort of frustrating people, and then Adam Back releasing Hashcash. Why was Hashcash so pivotal on this journey towards Bitcoin, in your opinion?
Yeah, so Adam Back designed Hashcash initially as postage. So it was meant to be postage. And the reason, so postage for the internet, for email essentially. And the reason that was very necessary at that time was because I mentioned that cypherpunks were using remailers. So this was a way to email someone anonymously, email someone without that person knowing that it was you who emailed them. So these were cypherpunk tools that cypherpunks were running. Like, they were running remailer servers, but these servers were increasingly being spammed. So they were, basically some sort of denial of service attack seemed to be going on, where, you know, thousands of emails were just being sent through these servers consisting of gibberish, it seemed like. And these servers became too expensive or too burdensome to actually operate. So this is why the cypherpunk specifically wanted to create something akin to digital postage, so something that would come at a cost. Something that would make sending an email cost something. And they did think about using electronic cash for this, like Chom's electronic cash. You just put a little bit of eCash in an email, and only if it has this eCash in the email would you accept it, or would the remailer accept it. But eCash was not quite ready for this. It was not quite designed in such a way that it could be used for this. So then Adam Back came up with this idea for Hashcash, which, in order to send an email, the sender would have to perform a little bit of proof of work. So, you know, your computer does a bunch of computational cycles to prove that you actually spent energy. And then only if this proof of work was included in an email would the remailer accept it, or would the recipient accept it. What this really introduced, so this was the original intent for it, for Hashcash. But what it introduced was digital scarcity, essentially, right? So some way to create something that's digital, but that proves some sort of expense of real world resources, real energy, real computing power. And this really inspired a number of the cyberpunks to take their thinking about electronic cash in a new direction. So where previously the idea was, we're going to create digital cash that's sort of operated by a bank and it's backed by fiat currency, now they really started to think more in this way of digital gold kind of thing. Like, maybe we can have a digital cash that's not backed by something else. So they were having these discussions on the Cypherpunks mailing list, some of it which I detail in my book, about whether digital cash actually needs to be backed, whether it just needs to be limited, or whether it should be considered cash if it's not backed, or if it's backed. So they were starting to really consider this. And when Hashcash was introduced, a year later, you see these other digital cash protocols being proposed. So the most notable ones are Nixavo's Bitgold and Wydyce B-Money, which both use this scarcity, this provable scarcity, this proof of work as sort of the foundation, the fundament for their digital cash projects. Now, these digital cash projects had other problems, but you can really see this thinking to be embraced and sort of taken the whole concept of electronic cash in a new direction from that point out.
Yeah. And did Bitgold or B-Money ever leave the idea phase? Were they?
No. They were both just proposals. Mm-hmm. They were proposed very briefly after one another. There was only like a month in between them. But yeah, both had, fundamental problems, and maybe that's why they weren't, like, they couldn't have been implemented, basically, or, you know, you could have sort of tried, but there were very real problems that were unsolved still. So yeah, they were only ever ideas, proposals, where Bitgold is a pretty, I would say, relatively detailed proposal. B-Money is a little bit more hand-wavy, like that. B-Money is an even rougher idea than Bitgold, but yeah, both of them were not implemented.
Yeah, I discussed B-Money with Dhruv Bansal from Unchained probably about a month and a half ago now. Mm. At this point, he was explaining how the auction to create B-Money really doomed it from the beginning, because he didn't really have this fixed supply that people could anchor to. He sort of had to figure out a way to coordinate these auctions to birth the supply into existence.
Right, yeah. I would say B-Money was, it was an interesting idea. It was sort of almost wide-eye, kind of thinking out loud is how I sort of read it. By the time he published B-Money, he had grown sort of disillusioned with the whole digital cash movement, actually, or with the whole cypherpunk movement even. Because he felt that all these tools that cypherpunks were developing and all the ways they were thinking about improving privacy, it turned out that no one was interested, right? The internet had by this time started to become a real thing, and no one was using any of these privacy tools that the cypherpunks, you know, were putting their heart and soul in. No one gave a damn. So he also expected that even if they could realize digital cash, probably no one would even use it, because people are perfectly comfortable using credit cards or PayPal or whatever, you know, privacy infringing technologies are out there. So what's the point, sort of? So my reading of the situation is that Wydai had been thinking about it for a while, and at some point he kind of grew disillusioned and he just sort of said, all right, here's what I got so far. If someone wants to take this ball and run with it, go ahead. But it was still far from a finished protocol. But it had some interesting ideas in it, for sure.
Yeah, and how much do you think that disillusionment on the part of Wydai was the fact that he was so close to everything going on, was following this for years, that it didn't seem like there was mainstream adoption or even appetite to adopt? Like, how much of that was just a product of how nascent the internet was and consumers' access to the internet was at that time?
Well, I would say that in recent years, we've seen a bit of a resurgence of, you know, sort of the cypherpunk ethos, right? And part of this is Bitcoin itself. But you also see it in other domains as well. You know, we have Signal these days, even WhatsApp, like, implemented cryptography. So clearly, people at least pretend to care. Companies at least pretend to care, which probably means there's at least some market demand for it. Like, people, also the Snowden revelations, of course, were a big part of that. Like, it re-inspired thinking about privacy technologies or the lack thereof. But yeah, if you recall, definitely like the late 90s, early 2000s, when the internet was still pretty new, privacy was just not a topic that anyone really seemed to care about or mind. And so I can certainly see, you know, the cyberpunks that were sort of very early to the internet. And then when the masses sort of come and no one cares about what they thought everyone would care about, that must be a very disappointing realization. And it was for many of them. So yeah, the cypherpunk movement sort of dissolved around that time.
Yeah. And so this was like 1998 when B-Money was released. I'm sure there's a bunch of where the idea was released. There was probably discussion for some amount of time. And then obviously there's a 10-year gap between that and Bitcoin, the Bitcoin white paper appearing on the mailing list in October of 2008. Like, what happened between that 10-year period, that trough, yeah, well, there's disillusionment, if you will?
Yeah, well, there's one more interesting digital cash project in between these, which I highlight in my book. I will also say there were a lot of sort of electronic cash systems in name only during that time. So there were a lot of startups and technology companies that were selling or introducing something which they called cash for the internet in some way or another, but it didn't have any privacy features, that's for sure. So in whatever way, whatever they associated with cash, probably something like fast and cheap transactions, but privacy was just not part of any of these designs. But the interesting sort of cypherpunk technology, very late cypherpunk technology that still came out in between B-Money and Bitcoin was ARPU. So Hal Vinney, very telling for his character probably, he sort of kept his enthusiasm up. He was always very interested in new digital cash projects that were introduced on the Cypherpunk's mailing list. He was very often sort of the first to jump on it, try to understand it, and came back to the mailing list, sort of tried to explain it in his own words to other people on that list. So he was a very prominent figure there, especially in this electronic cash sort of subsegment of the cypherpunk community. And he was still motivated, and he was almost certainly one of the very few. Like, I think Nick Szabo, when I spoke with him, he said his estimation were that there were maybe like 3 or 4 people so interested in this stuff, like by the mid 2000s. But Hal Vinney was definitely one of them. He was still interested in specifically kind of realizing Bits, Gold, and B-Money type of ideas. Now, what he actually built was what he called a very simplified version of BitGold, which it had to be because BitGold was quite complex. There's like different layers to that design. So ARPU was a very simplified version, but it was kind of interesting that it leveraged sort of the transparency of free software so that even Hal Vinney couldn't cheat because it was a centralized system. So it sort of went back from decentralized proposals like B-Money and BitGold sort of were, and then it went back to ARPU, which was centralized. But Hal Vinney used a remote attestation technology, which was a special IBM chip, in combination with free software to sort of prove that the protocol did exactly what it had to do. Very relevant idea for Bitcoin as well, of course. So this technology came somewhere in between, and interestingly, it was also actually implemented. So it did work. It was really a thing people could use. Kind of interesting is that Greg Maxwell was also one of the contributors to this project, Bitcoin Core developer, of course. But it never really caught on. This is probably in large part because ARPU didn't have a solution for the inflation problem. So the currency was created with proof of work, but as computers become faster over time, it becomes easier to create proof of work. So you sort of have this intrinsic inflation because of that. And you know, if you know that your money is going to inflate, then it's not very strong incentive to want to accept it, of course. So that's probably a big reason why ARPU didn't take off, or at least that's what I think. That's what Greg Maxwell thinks as well. But it did operate, it did work for a while.
Mm-hmm. So that gets to the question of what is the core innovation of Bitcoin? That's, again, going back to the conversation with Dhruv. He wrote a piece recently that really puts the case forward that digital scarcity and a fixed supply of 21 million with a predetermined supply schedule, release schedule is the key innovation, obviously, with the combination of proof of work with the difficulty adjustment and leveraging ECDSA to create private public key pairs, all that combined really allowed Bitcoin to succeed in the way that it has over the first 15 years. But it was really that last piece of the puzzle, figuring out like, hey, we need a fixed supply out of the gate that's predetermined.
Yeah, I think the big thing Bitcoin did was getting the incentives right. As I mentioned, ARPAO basically worked. Like, if you just wanted to use digital cash, then ARPAO, it worked. Or even eCash, you know, the technology worked. But also eCash was not adopted, probably for the same reason. Like, there's no strong incentive to adopt eCash. Like, some people care about privacy, sure. But a lot of people also don't care about privacy. While, you know, if there's a monetary or if there's a financial incentive to adopt a currency, well, now all of a sudden, a lot more people will care. So I also think that's a big piece of the puzzle that Satoshi sort of got right. If you look at these different electronic cash projects that preceded Bitcoin, then almost all different parts of the puzzle are there in one of them. Like, Bitgold already very much has something that starts to resemble a blockchain with like this chain of hashes, essentially. B-Money already introduced this idea that everyone should run their own node in a way, that everyone should keep track of everyone else's balances. ARPAO leverages this free software idea that anyone can check the code. Of course, Hashcash as proof of work, like a lot of these tools were there. A lot of the parts of the puzzle were there. And Satoshi definitely, in my view as well, he put it together in a way that's not just very elegant, but also the incentives now for the first time aligned. There was actually a reason for people to want to get some of these coins because the value might go up. And that's a big motivator to get digital cash, even if you don't care about the privacy aspect of it.
Yeah. And when Satoshi hit the mailing list with the white paper in October of 2008, like, in your mind, what reaction did this cause the greater cypherpunk movement to have? Well, obviously, Hal Finney was in early. I believe it was Wei Dai, was highly skeptical in the beginning. What was the reemergence of this idea of digital cash and the way that Satoshi brought it back? How did it sort of disrupt that community?
Right. Well, you mentioned Wei Dai. He was emailed before it even hit the mailing list. So both Adam Back and Wei Dai were reached out to privately by Satoshi. And both of them weren't buying it, so to say, which to a large extent has to do with the disillusionment that I already mentioned. And also there had been so many digital cash products that just went nowhere. So it's very understandable, I would say, if, you know, someone you've never heard of reaches out, says, I fixed the problem. It's very natural to be skeptical, I would say. That's totally normal, I think. And that's also what you saw on the Cypherpunk mailing list for the most part. So, yeah, the initial responses were definitely either indifferent. And I should mention, by the way, at this point, the Cypherpunk's mailing list had, for all practical reasons, been dissolved. And now the sort of more serious cryptography mailing list had taken over. Like, a lot of the same people started to discuss their ideas and strategies there. So it was very similar, but it was a bit more moderated to limit the amount of flame wars and spam and that sort of stuff. But yeah, for the most part, I would say it was indifference. And then those that did pay attention to the email either didn't believe in it or just didn't understand it. I quote some of these emails in my book, or at least some parts of it. Like, I forgot who it actually was. I forgot the name of the person that sent this email, but someone, funnily enough, suggests that Bitcoin seems like a pretty good idea, but it should have a difficulty adjustment algorithm, which it did. So clearly you didn't understand the proposal very well, which I should also say, also very understandable. You know, we live in 2024 now, and now if you get into Bitcoin and you type it into YouTube, there's like a million colorful explainer videos, and everyone wrote an article or a book like me about how Bitcoin works. And but if it's 2008 and you've never heard of this, and there's just this white paper from this one guy you don't know, and you're sort of just reading through it, yeah, obviously most people wouldn't understand it perfectly the first time around. So I'm not like judging these people, it's just noticeable that they didn't quite get it. But yeah, again, the noticeable exception is, of course, Hal Vinny. So Hal Vinny still at it, just like on the Cypherpunks mailing list, often sort of the first to take an interest, try to understand it, ask questions, try to re-explain it to other people. And you still see this in 2008 when Bitcoin is first introduced by Satoshi, that Hal is still this guy that sort of what's the English word? Enthusiastic? That's not the English word. What's the English word, Marty?
Enthusiastic?
Is that just an English word?
Enthusiastic? I don't know. I don't know the etymology. Definitely is an English word.
Okay, I think we're good then. Yeah, but so Hal Vinny is definitely still one of these guys, pretty much the only one who's still enthusiastic about this new idea and sort of... And he starts to help Satoshi as well for the months that follow with some bug fixes, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But pretty quickly, like if you read it back now, like within like a couple of, maybe like a couple dozen emails, maybe not even a couple dozen, the discussion about Bitcoin is sort of cut short by the moderator of the cryptography mailing list, Perry Metzger, in this way of, you know, let's see code first before we continue discussing this, which retrospectively, it's kind of funny. It's like, you know, me, I'm like a, you know, I'm digging through these archives kind of like as a historian doing my research, and then this super revolutionary idea is invented, and then you got this guy cutting down the discussion. Like, no, I want to read what everyone had to say about it. And this is like a gold mine, and now it's over. So, yeah.
And was that even correct? Because didn't Satoshi say that he wrote the code before he wrote the paper because he wanted to make sure it worked?
He started writing a code before the paper. Yeah, that's right. But he published the paper before the code. So there was still a couple of months between paper and code, of course. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he said he'd been working on it for like 2 years before publishing the white paper. That's right. That's true.
Yeah. So obviously January 3rd, 2009 is when the protocol, or at least when the Genesis block was mined.
January 3rd is the Genesis block, and then January 8th, it was actually announced, shared on the cryptography mailing list.
Mm-hmm. And at that point, it was still just the Genesis block, right? No other blocks have been mined.
Yeah. It was just the Genesis block embedded in the code, of course. There had been no, or at least, you know, we can't be completely 100% sure in retrospect, but at least according to the timestamps in the blocks, these were all found after the code was released on the mailing list. Now, you know, if you want to get conspiratorial or whatever, it's of course possible that Satoshi would have sort of mined these before releasing the code and embedding fake timestamps in the blocks, but there's no indication that he actually did that. I don't think he did that, but we can't be 100% sure based on the blockchain alone.
No.
We can be 100% sure, of course, that the Genesis block was not mined before January 3rd because it had this headline in the Genesis block.
Yep. And for anybody out there listening, the beauty of the Genesis block, not only with the headline in the Coinbase transaction, but it can't be spent. So that was sort of an interesting decision that Satoshi made, like, hey, I'm going to mine this first block just to get this started, but I'm not going to be able to spend any of the Bitcoin that's officially mined.
Yeah, very cool touch, I think. Like even Satoshi himself had to earn his coins just like everyone else. That's true.
Yeah. And so what do you think, having done all this deep dives into the history of the economic theory and the cypherpunk movement that led to Bitcoin, what was the emergence of Satoshi and the Bitcoin project? Like, what impact did that have on the cypherpunk movement overall, particularly over the last 15 years? Like, would you say the movement's stronger than ever? Has it gone astray at all? Was Satoshi a figure that breathed life back into it?
I mean, I think the ideas and the ideals of the cypherpunks live on, but the movement itself is not really... Insofar, it's still a movement. It's definitely not what it used to be. Like, it used to be, as I mentioned, both this sort of in-person thing in California, where at the beginning, maybe like 15 people showed up. And then it became this early internet phenomenon with the mailing list, which, as I mentioned, at its peak had like 2,000 people on there, although most of these people were just reading. And yeah, I mean, today there's still people that call themselves cypherpunks, obviously, and some of the technologies live on, Bitcoin being an obvious one, but you could also count, you know, something like Tor or even something like Signal. I think that's perfectly fair to consider these cypherpunk technologies. WikiLeaks, of course, was also a very cypherpunk thing. Assange himself was on the cypherpunks mailing list. So these ideas live on, but yeah, to really consider it still a cypherpunk movement, not in the way it was anyways. There's no central mailing list like that anymore. There's still the cryptography mailing list, which is still going. So that's still living on. But I think, you know, someone like Tim May was such a sort of central figure, and his ideas and his contributions, and that really sort of attracted a lot of attention and it set the tone to a large extent for the cypherpunk community, I would say. And so with him gone and with the mailing list gone, and I think it's a bit of a stretch to say that there's still a cypherpunk community, but the ideas live on.
Yeah. Maybe these are communities, movements, if you will, that need to be somewhat ephemeral. People take their ideas, we take them somewhere else, build another community. Maybe that's like the whack-a-mole that's necessary to actually get these technologies into the hands of the mainstream users.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, even the mailing list, like if the philosophy of the cypherpunks is sort of this decentralized movement that has no structure and no one, you know, dictating where it goes, then it's kind of natural, of course, that it just goes wherever. And the mailing list, for example, itself was hosted for a long time by John Gilmore. He at some point didn't want to do it. So then kind of the big migration happened. It migrated to Usenet for a while, and then there were different servers sort of hosting that. And as I mentioned, the cryptography mailing list took it over. But yeah, I think that's probably a pretty good assessment, that almost by its very nature of being this decentralized, leaderless, structureless thing, it just kind of spreads to wherever and goes wherever. And it becomes hard to sort of pin down in any central place or point.
Yeah. And one thing, going through this history, I can't help but think of how important timing is, and the timing of when Satoshi released the white paper and then eventually launched the protocol was so beautifully perfect in the midst of the great financial crisis. Obviously, with the message in the Genesis block, he was certainly making somewhat of a political statement when he launched the protocol. And I think it's clear to me, at least, it was an idea, digital cash more broadly, whose time had come. And Satoshi, luckily for us, figured out the perfect ingredients to get something together that actually works.
Yeah, that's still an incredible part of the story, right? How perfect the timing was. And also, again, like if you imagine, let's, you know, imagine that Bitcoin does become this big success, hyper Bitcoinization happens. Like, future historians must be so incredibly astonished by the timing of it all, and just the sort of bottom up nature of it. Like, there's this big financial crisis going on, and the solution is somehow found on this niche mailing list with this paper by this anonymous guy. It's kind of mind blowing if you.
It's almost biblical when you think about it. And you
put
that
well, exactly, right? Yeah. It's really incredible.
Yeah. And then speaking to timing too, like other, like Chom, great idea with Mint. Like, maybe you just needed to wait till Bitcoin was launched and then you can build more, you can build Mints the correct way, leveraging something like the Fedimint protocol. There was a talk that Hal Finney gave back in the 90s about zero knowledge proofs. And how they could be implemented, and now people are figuring out ways to leverage ZKPs to help with initial block download in Bitcoin. Like, these ideas that were brought into existence decades ago, and maybe the timing wasn't right. Like, it just took Bitcoin to be released, and then you can implement them the correct way, which is also fascinating to think about.
Yeah, it's really cool to see some of these technologies, eCash being the most obvious example, I would say. Yeah, really cool to see that being rediscovered. Like, when I started my research, that wasn't the case at all. So this really sort of happened during that I was writing about this stuff. I'm not saying it has anything to do with me. That's not the claim at all. I'm just saying it's interesting to see how, like, as I was sort of discovering these things, it's also been rediscovered in a Bitcoin context, and people now actually start to build these technologies on Bitcoin, which seems like, yeah, a very good match to me anyways. David Chaum is not really a Bitcoiner. He
started his own privacy coin, didn't he?
Yeah, he was involved with like Elixir for a little while. I have no idea what happened with that. Although I think Elixir was supposed to also support Bitcoin, like it was supposed to also be a mixer for Bitcoin, but I'm going off my suboptimal memory at this point, and I don't know for sure what the idea was there. I don't think it went anywhere, right?
I don't think so. But it is interesting, right? Because you imagine Chom did that because he's looking at Bitcoin and the trade-offs that Satoshi made, particularly as they pertain to privacy, not what he probably would have won it as a privacy idealist. And it's interesting now that Chaumia Mints are being launched on top of Bitcoin, which give Bitcoin users that privacy within these Fedimints or just these single operator mints like Cashew.
It's also
he's kicking himself in the butt, like, maybe if I was patient and thought creatively about this, like, you can have it. It's just going to take time. And in my mind, like, I think the trade-offs that were made as it pertains to privacy, while they're hard to stomach for a lot, I do think they're worthwhile at the protocol level, and you can just push that up to other layers.
Yeah, it also, it's interesting, I mentioned BitGold, so Nick Szabo's idea, and how that was pretty complex. It's kind of complex, but the reason it's complex, or the reason I say that, is because it actually also had different layers, essentially. So it also had like sort of this base layer idea, which can be, you know, that was the actual BitGold, so to say. That was sort of this digital scarcity, this proof of work type of currency. But then he imagined a sort of free banking layer on top of it, which would be more suited to make the actual payments and to make the actual transactions on. So this also, you know, this is very similar to the direction that even today, sort of the prominent Bitcoin developers or, you know, Bitcoin thinkers are kind of thinking about scaling. Like, this seems like a plausible way that Bitcoin might actually scale, you know, through layers and through some sort of, whether it's Fedimint or whether it's different types of, you know, whether you want to call them banks or with different trust models, and how these are then sort of connected over the Lightning Network. Like, it really resembles something that Nick Szabo was speculating BitGold should be designed as. So you see these echoes, and you see these lessons from the past sort of being either rediscovered or reinvented, and it's definitely the lineage is clearly there with the whole digital cash project and Bitcoin.
Yeah, and speaking of the free banking conversation in Bitgold, and how much that Bitgold project influenced Hal Finney. It's funny, in the early days in December 2010, when he took to the BitcoinTalk.org forum to basically lay out the case, said like, hey, we're going to scale in a free banking model where Bitcoin will be a reserve asset in these private banks, and they'll issue, he said, their own currencies. I don't think he could have foresaw something like the Fediment protocol or Lightning materializing at that time, but you could see he was directionally right, if you believe this is the optimal scaling path.
Well, you could argue that Fediment in particular does sort of issue its own currency, right? They're tokens that are backed by Bitcoin. So in that sense, it's actually very similar. Now, I don't think Fediment is using fractional reserve, or at least that's not the plan, right? While this sort of Celgene type of idea did use fractional reserve explicitly. There was actually an earlier draft of my book explored this whole part of free banking and George Celgene's ideas, but I ended up not using most of that because it was kind of speculating about the future of Bitcoin, while I really wanted my book to be grounded in the history and just sort of, you know, what we know rather than what might be in the future. But George Celgene still makes a couple of appearances throughout the book here and there. Like, he was on the same mailing list as Nick Szabo and White Eye and a couple of these people. So there was the Cypherpunks mailing list, and then there was also the Liptech mailing list, which was a more focused mailing list on digital cash. And that also had some of these free banking types on there, and they were sort of sharing their ideas with the, you know, some of these cypherpunks on there. So this includes George Celgene and Lawrence White. So that makes a couple of appearances in my book. Like, Hayek's idea of free banking, as I mentioned earlier, is sort of a big threat throughout my book. And there you can see the lineage to how these ideas started to inspire some of the cypherpunks as well, specifically through this other mailing list, for example.
Yeah. No, it's fast. It is, again, going back to the beauty of like the economic side of things, like the economic theorists really recognizing that the cryptographers were onto something, that if they were gonna put their economic theory into practice, they're gonna have to leverage something that the cypherpunks were building and sort of combining their minds to really push this forward. It's just incredibly fascinating. All in mailing list too.
Yes, and this idea is also merged within the Extropian community. So this was this sort of futurist community that had all of these ideas about life extension, cloning, space colonization, like all kinds of wild ideas. But they were serious about it. And the way they believed it could be achieved was by limiting the role of government in society, essentially. They saw government as, you know, sort of a leech on economic activity, and they believed if you let the people experiment, and if you let the free market reign, we can achieve all of these interesting technologies that would reshape society and even transform humanity itself. And a number of the cypherpunks and Bitcoin sort of fathers, or, you know, prehistory godfathers like Hal Finney, they were also on this Extropian list. And it was Hal Finney that introduced digital cash to this list as a way to sort of get government out of your life, specifically sort of get government out of your finances, like the privacy angle. And then some of the Extropians, like the founder, who's called Max Moore, he's still around, by the way, he really saw this potential, which you just mentioned, of leveraging this electronic cash technology, not just for privacy, but also for monetary reform, to sort of realize Hayek's ideas about money. That's really something he started pushing for, and ideas he started to spread, including to some of these other cypherpunks that were there, which, as I mentioned, included, yeah, not just Hal Finney, but Wydai, Nigzabo, Tim May, like a bunch of these guys were there and getting these ideas and sharing these ideas.
That's interesting. Now that you mentioned that and go through that story, I think it we're at the beginning of a similar story with this effective acceleration movement and Bitcoin. I think there's a lot of people in Bitcoin, particularly looking at what's going on in the EACC movement, which is predominantly being driven by people working on artificial intelligence and being like, hey, I think we should talk. I think there's some way Bitcoin can play into this. And I think our philosophical ideas of where society should be going are pretty aligned. And you could see the sort of intermingling of the Bitcoin culture and this EACC culture beginning to collide and really work with each other to take us to the next step forward.
Sorry, I don't know what is this EAEC. Can you explain?
So it's a play on effective altruism, which Sam Bankman-Fried was a big advocate of. It's effective accelerationism, which is there's two competing forces in the world right now, those who want to accelerate and those who want to decelerate, the accelerationist aligning more with the, what was it, the Etropian mailing list that you described?
Extropian, yeah, it was Extropian. A community. They had a magazine and a mailing list as well, yeah.
Yeah, so they're probably the Extropians of the modern day, really saying, hey, government, get out of the way. We shouldn't create regulatory moats around artificial intelligence. You should let people experiment with this and create their own models. And they're ardently juxtaposing themselves versus those who would like to see regulatory moats and the deceleration of the proliferation of these technologies.
Right, interesting. Yeah, that sounds pretty similar. That sounds very Extropian. They're basically Extropians, it sounds like, yeah.
Yeah, and so like it does seem like, particularly when you think of things like L402 and all the lessons that the Bitcoin mining industry has learned with the energy sector, like AI is very controversial these days, but I use it myself. It is certainly useful in many contexts. It can be harmful too, but all technologies can be used for good or bad. You can make the argument at the end of the day.
What do you use it for, like text?
Text, image generation. We're using it to help curate content on the site and then create thumbnails.
Right.
Like this will be put through a transcription. Artificial intelligence will have a transcript of this episode within minutes after we plug it in and then other things. But like the conversions of Bitcoin in AI, I think it's symbiotic. Like, I think there's ways you can leverage artificial intelligence to have something like more efficient channel management on the Lightning Network, more efficient fee estimation softwares. And then likewise, I think Bitcoin, particularly over the Lightning Network, can make the AI products more efficient, where if you want to get rid of your chargeback risk, you're spending a lot of money on the compute. Just put a Lightning Network enabled paywall for compute in front of it. And then again, going back to mining, the mining industry has learned a lot about the energy sector, and AI is obviously going to be energy intensive too. And due to the nature of the need for 100% uptime of these GPU data centers and the artificial intelligence arena, I do think there's going to be co-location of Bitcoin ASICs that can participate in demand response and these GPU farms that are looking for low cost energy. And the only way to get that low cost energy is to participate in demand response, and you need the Bitcoin miners for that. So I think there's a bunch of synergies, and right now the Extropian sphere and the Cypherpunk digital cash Bitcoin sphere are like a little bit disconnected, but you can see them sort of beginning to recognize like, hey, we may be able to help each other out here.
Yeah, I mean, they're very they share a history, not just in the Extropian domain I mentioned, but you could argue even the very early history. Like I mentioned, I start my book with sort of the emergence of the hacker culture, and that actually was at the AI lab of MIT. So just when computers, you know, were first around, you got the first experimentations and the first idea of creating AI was, you know, at the very beginning was like creating chess computers and that kind of stuff. But that happened at the same place where, you know, the hacker culture emerged, and from there, public key cryptography was invented. So it has a common ancestor, and it's not a that surprising to see that they would find each other again now or in the future.
Yeah, it's like they converge, diverge, reemerge.
Right.
It's a beautiful thing. And it's important to know the history. I guess this is a good point to like pitch the book. Like, why do you think people should understand the context of everything that came before Bitcoin?
Yeah, well, I mean, I am a historian technically, and the reason for that is that just in general, I believe if you want to understand why things are the way they are, if you want to understand why society is the way it is, why we have the institutions we have, it helps to understand where it all came from. And I think the same is true for Bitcoin. If you want to understand why Bitcoin is designed the way it is, why it was invented, it really helps, or maybe it's even necessary to sort of understand where it came from. I mentioned that, you know, Bitcoin sort of consists of all these building blocks that kind of predate Bitcoin, and also the economic ideas that are sort of embedded in Bitcoin. Like, it all predates Bitcoin, and it was all brought together at some point. And I do think, I sort of had two goals with my book, you could say. There's sort of two layers to it. One layer is, if you already know a lot about Bitcoin, then it's hopefully, you know, interesting to learn where it all came from. But also, if you don't know a lot about Bitcoin, I hope that it's a good way to actually understand Bitcoin in this really sort of step-by-step way, where one step at a time, you know, public key cryptography is explained and proof of work, and then why these guys wanted to create this and where the economic ideas come from. So it's a good way to understand Bitcoin itself as well. I hope that's the goal anyways, or one of the goals.
Yeah, well, if you're going to learn from anybody in the space, I can speak from experience, having learned a ton throughout my time in Bitcoin from Aaron. You should go pick up the book, because I completely agree. To know where we are and where we may be going, you have to understand where we came from, and diving into the history of the cypherpunk movement and all the iterations on digital cash that led to Bitcoin is extremely important, particularly if you're one of those individuals who's new to Bitcoin out there, is convinced that it's the MySpace, that it's the first ever digital currency. It's wrong on its face. There was a lot of prehistory that led to Bitcoin.
Right. Yeah. Bitcoin is the first one that actually works. It's not the first one. It's the first one that got it right, you could say. Yeah. And I do think, if you... That becomes maybe more clear if you read my book. I'm done selling my book, but yeah, that is...
No, you're not done yet. Where can we find the book? That's the next question.
Oh, well, let me first finish this point. Like, yeah, that is a very common, you know, critique of Bitcoin, that it's just the first of its kind and something better will come along. And I do think that, you know, if you read this prehistory, then it's clear that no, Bitcoin actually wasn't the first. There were other digital currency projects before it, including some that actually existed, that some people used, you know, like MySpace actually existed and some people use it. But Bitcoin is the first one that's actually succeeding. That's one of the insights you could take away. Where can people find it? Well, it's on Amazon. It's on the Bitcoin Magazine store. You can also just go to thegenesisbook.com and you'll find what you need there, hopefully.
Not only is it on Amazon, it's a bestseller on Amazon. I checked this morning.
It was for a brief moment in the Netherlands, for like a day in the Netherlands, it was the number one best-selling book, like on Amazon in the country. That was pretty ace. I didn't expect that. Like, out of all books, not just some category, but just the best-selling book in the Netherlands, just for a day, but still, that was pretty cool.
I'm going to take this screenshot and put it, Logan. Number one new release, according to my Amazon account here in the U.S. So it's still got a... We'll put this on the screen so people know what the...
Well, that's probably in some... It must be in some category, right?
Development and growth economics. That's a good... That's a good...
I'll take it.
That's a good one to be in. while this is uploading. Anything else that we didn't touch on? You think people should be aware of? Are you optimistic about where Bitcoin is and where it's going right now?
Yes, I mean, I think it's going pretty well. I would say I've been kind of zoned out of the sort of daily. You know, during the block size war, I was very involved with everything that was going every week. I was tuned in and I was in every like chat group everywhere and sort of keeping a pulse on everything I could. And then during the writing of my book, I've sort of, you know, zoomed out a bit. So I'm not very involved in like the JPEG war or whatever the kids are fighting over these days. But in general, it seems to be doing pretty well to me. I don't see anything wrong. What do you think?
Yeah, I've been keeping my pulse on the space, but the JPEG wars, as you call them, I've been. Yeah, it seems like noise to me. It'll come and go.
I mean, to me, like, isn't this what the block size wars were kind of about? Like, we have a block size limit, so blocks can't be too big. And now, if you want to stuff them with nonsense, well, you gotta have to pay for it. That's sort of the point of the block size limit for a large extent. So I'm not too worried about that. As far as I can tell, Bitcoin is still working. A block is still mined every 10 minutes. There's now even ETFs. There's the price is doing pretty well. I'm a happy camper, Marty.
I am as well. And I think maybe most importantly, the outside world seems to be getting crazier and crazier. So that plays to our benefit as well.
Right. Bitcoin is sort of this central point of sanity in a crazy world. It does feel like that sometimes to me, anyways.
That's the way I like to visualize Bitcoin. In my own mind, it's just this like beam of light in the center of a town that we can all access and like anchor into. And it's just always going to be beaming at the same.
Yeah, the same pretty power. Much. Yes, exactly.
Well, Aaron, I can't believe it took us this long, but I'm happy.
Yeah, it was fun to finally be on.
Yeah, we'll have to do it again. If you're ever stateside, let me know. Come to Texas. Yeah, let's
do it in person sometimes. Where are you, Austin?
Yeah.
I've never been to Austin, so I should at some point.
You got to come. There's people working on Chalmia Mints right behind me, literally.
Nice.
Behind this wall.
Next time I'm there, I'll ping you.
All right. You go enjoy your night. Thank you for doing this and keep crushing it, dude.
Yes. Thanks for having me.
All right. Peace and love, freaks.